Hello, this is Dave Sanderson. You're listening to Awaken Nation with Brad Solace.
A huge shift is taking place on planet Earth. People seem to be waking up, tired of the way things used to be. They are creating something brand new and changing the world we live in. My name is Brad Solace, and I get to sit down with the next generation of idea makers, the disruptors, and the game changers. Everyday people, just like you and me, from all over. We're doing amazing things. Welcome to Awakened Nation.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, I have a good friend of mine on, Dave Sanderson. And if you don't know who he is, he's part of the Miracle on the Hudson. You remember when US Airways Flight 1549 was ditching the Hudson River? You can watch our first interview with him. I'll leave that link in the notes. But Dave, I want to welcome you back to Awakened Nation, my friend.
Well, Brad, thank you for having me again. I truly appreciate it and honor our friendship. Thank you so much.
Thank you, brother. I've just been, the reason I wanted to have you back on, and I apologize for not having you back on early, but I can see you've really kicked it up a notch over the last 2 to 3 years. We're going to take a deep dive into something called post-traumatic growth syndrome. We're going to talk about that. Dave's going to talk about a little bit about his experience from being the last person off that airplane on that cold winter day in New York City, diving into the Hudson River, and how he was trained. You trained with Navy SEALs, is that correct?
I swam with Navy SEALs. That's correct. Back in the Hudson River, that's correct.
While most of us are winding down our lives when we hit a certain age, Dave is winding up. So we're going to talk about that. Dave, thank you for being on Awakened Nation, my friend.
Well, thank you again. Look forward to this.
So what prompted you to want to start training with Navy SEALs? What was that?
Brad, it wasn't my design. All right. The short version of a long story is I was standing in Newark Airport, as you probably have done many times.
Yep.
I was actually looking out the window, looking at New York City, right? Beautiful view of New York City. I got a phone call from a friend who's a captain in the Navy. And she told me she was going to be swimming with the Navy SEALs going from Liberty State Park, New Jersey, all the way to New York City, 3.1 miles. And would I swim with her? And she said, it might get some redemption going back in the river. And first I'm thinking, what's this all about? Second, I said, I'm intrigued. So hook me up with your guy, your Navy SEAL guy. And she did. And I talked to his name was his call sign is Scuba. So that's what gives you a little perspective. Right. And, I was still going back and forth. And he said, show up 2 days from now, which was a Thursday, 5 a.m. I want to see you swim. And first test, Brad, was showing up at 5 a.m., right? I mean, showing up. I mean, that's number one. So I passed test number one. But then he cleared the lane. So everybody in this whole pool is looking at me, man. And he said, jump in and swim 25 yards, right? I get in, I could barely swim 25 yards. Because I had swam since 1979, you know, I mean, here and there a little bit, right? But nothing's so he's looking at me and saying, you know, you got a lot of work to do. But if you're serious, see Coach Patty tomorrow at 5 a.m. and she'll show you how to swim. And I came back and 5 a.m. the next morning in my little shorts, no goggles, nothing. She said, show me how you swim. And she's like, whoa, we got a lot of work to do. She goes, but if you show up every morning at 5 a.m., I'll show you how to do this and we'll get this thing done. So for the next 100 days, Brad, I every morning at 5 a.m. was at the pool, at the lake, trying to learn how to swim because I thought I knew how to swim. I don't know how to swim like these guys know how to swim, right? I mean, so that's how it came about. And, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, game time comes and you're standing there. Yeah, you know, thinking, yeah, you know, why? Because one thing, Brad, I do, and yeah, you know, people who play athletics probably do this. They put the game plan together, right? So I had a game plan on the plane crash, and we watched the video. Coach Payne and I watched the video of the previous year's swim. All right, so we wanted to get an idea. In the previous year's swim, Brad, and there's a reason I'm telling you this. Is they actually walked over a bridge, walked down to the little beach right there, right? And they all jumped in and started swimming around the turn to the Statue of Liberty. That's how they began the year before. So that's the game plan, right?
Right.
And we're going to walk down. We're going to get in the water. Dave's got about 500 or so yards, get himself figured out, right? And then we're going to go. Well, as we're walking across the bridge, a couple of these Navy SEALs get another perspective, another idea. They start jumping off this 13-foot bridge into the Hudson River. I had never jumped off a 13-foot bridge with my little fins on. And I'm looking at Suzanne, my wingman. I'm like, well, she goes, you got to go. So you can't wussy out, right? You can't wussy out now, right? So that's how it began, man. It's like, you know, it was like, oh my, now we're in the game. And with these Navy SEALs, but I was very honored to do that. There's a lot of lessons that came out of that. But, you know, the reason I actually did it was to raise money for vets that have fallen on hard times, especially since COVID. Because the suicide rate is out of control.
It is.
It's stated at 22 suicides a day in the military. That's what the stated number is. Mm-hmm. I hallucinate it's probably more than that. So that's why we initially did it.
God bless you, man. Because I know that's 100 days of training. 5 a.m. you have to be there. That means you got up probably 3:30, 4 o'clock every day. All I can say, folks, is what are you willing to do something like this? What are you willing to do to transform your life? And I take my hat off to you, Dave, for doing that because it is. It's a mindset. It was a passion. And it also, I believe, was to relive that moment of jumping into the cold water and swimming across the Hudson. What were you thinking at that time? Because you're swimming. And what's going through your mind?
Yeah, the biggest challenge my team thought that I would have besides just getting across the Hudson River was that initial shock in the water. Because, you know, if you've been in that region and you know the Hudson River, it's very, it's a very rough river. It's pretty nasty. So I'll give you a couple of different things. Number one, when I jumped in, I hit the water initially. All of a sudden, at that instant, I smelled, felt, remembered everything from that day.
Wow.
And it hit me, right? And especially the smell. You know, the olfactory is what stays with you longer than anything else in of the senses. It's olfactory.
It's true.
So that smell is, and that person, for I have to admit, for a few seconds, probably 15 to 30 seconds, I was stunned. I was like, wow. But you got to keep going because the currents are so fast, right? You can't. So, fortunately for me, I had to keep going. But that initial shock of that smell really hit me from that from going back to that point. It was 12 years prior to that point. But I think one thing I take away from this and share with business people is I used a strategy that I used in business to do this in 100 days. And this is one of the things I talk and teach about now, because as you know, as a business person, there's a strategy for everything. There is a strategy. All I did was follow the strategy that I did in sales for many years on how to get something I want. And, you know, people say, well, how'd you do it in 100 days? I used the strategy. So, you know, as you know, if you want to make change, if you want to get an outcome, you can actually get it done if you model somebody who's actually done it. And that's and do exactly. So that's what I did. And that's how I did it. But I have to admit, it was, you know, that swim, that was the initial shock. But the second point that I wanted to point out was on the third leg, when you go from Ellis Island to New York City. You finally get there, you're in there, you're swimming. And we're about 500-600 yards away from New York City, right? It's right there.
Yeah.
We're almost there. And Brad, I took a stroke and I turned my head. And all of a sudden, I turned to the left. And it was roughly about maybe a quarter, maybe a half, maybe a quarter, half mile. It's where the plane crashed.
Wow.
Because if you look left, you see the Intrepid, right? In New York City, where the Intrepid is, right there in Midtown. Yeah. And I knew where the Intrepid was. I saw the Intrepid, I looked over, and also I had stunned again. It's like, because also I'm reliving that plane crash. And then, fortunately, my wingman stuck with me, and she did a tremendous job. And those are the two moments where I had, man, sudden rush of emotion that really came over my body and came over my mind.
This is a testament to you. And a lot of times they say this, you get back on the horse. You know, if you've been thrown, you get back on the horse. And you got back on the horse and you pushed through it. And I want to ask you this question. This is maybe off the cuff a little bit, but I learned in life, I was always taught there are two kinds of people, those who run into danger and those who run away from danger. You know, our firefighters, our police officers, our military, God bless them, they run towards danger. But there's a third kind of person that I've met through the years, and that is the person who freezes in danger. Yeah. What do you recommend for people in leadership positions if maybe they have that trait of freezing?
Yeah, and I thank you for that question, because if you know a little bit about my story about that day, there was a lady who froze. Whether it was shock, stifle, whatever term you want to use, she wasn't moving, right? And what I've learned through my career and how I've handled it personally and how I hopefully helped that day was you got to help break people's patterns. You got to break the pattern of what you see. And there's a lot of ways to do that, right? But there's three major ways you do it. Number one, through your physiology, right? The way you move your body. So that's number one. Number two, though, is the internal dialogue. You know, what you're saying, right, to yourself and outwardly. And third is what you focus on. Those are the three different ways. So, you know, I recommend to people, and what I did that day is I yelled at this lady to get her attention, and I got her attention, right? And some people actually, Brad, came back to me, some of the people said, you know, that was awful mean. When I tell people, you know, why you're in life and death, and you got to check all that at the door. You got to do what you got to do. But if you're in a situation where you freeze, you got to start an internal representation. You got to start changing what you think about. It's like, okay, yeah, you can go in that gap all you want and say, you know, what am I going to do? Or if I could do this, how would I do it? And change that question. So it's the question you ask yourself, and or move your body very significantly, how you move your body. That's what I did. And that's what I coach people to do.
It's powerful, because anybody who's listening, if you have ever caught yourself in that moment, and you realize you're either one of those three people, you either run towards danger, run away, or freeze. Listen to what Dave just said. Train yourself, retrain yourself. Phenomenal. Thank you. I want to talk about your TED Talk, and my hat's off to you for doing the TED Talk. It was phenomenal. But you talked about bouncing back. This is the title of Dave's TED Talk. You can look it up, folks. I'll have it in the show links, but it's Bouncing Back, an Experience with Post-Traumatic Growth Syndrome. And you stood on that stage in front of the red round carpet, and you said, everybody said I was going to be depressed. I wasn't. Everybody said I was going to be this. I wasn't. Let's talk about that. Why do you think you didn't have the depression and the trauma and the fear and all this that everybody else did? And I know you talked about it in the TED Talk, but
I appreciate you bringing that up, because candidly, I wasn't. That TED Talk came out of the blue for me because of an article that was written on the AARP magazine, and you know, being on a TED Talk, you have like 17 minutes, so you gotta condense this stuff down. But when I said that, it's like, you know, why did it happen to me? So first thing I just said, I asked myself a different question, right? Why did it happen to me? And there's a few things that I did. And I think I maybe differently or in a different way than some other people. Number one, and one of the things I learned is when you get in that situation, you got to get it out, and you get that fear, and it's like, you know, you're depressed. You got to get it out of your body. You got to get it out of your body some way. And so what I did, as you probably know, I went out and started speaking. And when you speak, it gets it out of your body. It gets that message out. So first thing I did was I spoke that next weekend.
Right.
Got to start getting out of my body. Second was the meaning that I attached to it. A lot of people that day who had challenges or depression or PTSD, whichever level they were, basically had a different meaning. The meaning a lot of people attached to it was a devastating experience, a traumatic experience, and started running that pattern in their head. The meaning I attached to that, it was a blessing for me.
Right.
Well, how could a plane crash be a blessing? Way it was a blessing, I rationalized it was, it gave me the opportunity to do something different to impact somebody else's life. So the meaning you attach. And the third thing is you got to change your state, the way you manage your state. And a lot of people are depressed. You look the way they walk, they talk, they're slow, they're looking down, they're not giving eye contact. You got to change the way you move. And what I was talking about, move, what you focus on, and what you're telling yourself. one of those three ways. So those are three things that I did that helped me take a what's called a growth pattern instead of a depression's pattern.
Right. I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, I had a rough childhood and I didn't want to feel that way. You know, I didn't want to feel, you know, down and depressed. And so I kind of invented an alter ego for myself, which is confident, cool, up to date, you know, whatever. And I walked differently. I actually practiced my walk because I didn't want to be seen that way. And, you know, I had a choice. I could have, you know, wallowed in self-pity, maybe even wound up in suicide, or stood up and gained strength and confidence. And I find that sometimes these traumatic things, breakdowns create breakthroughs, as they say. Would you say that's true?
I believe that. I believe, and it's all what you focus on, right? First power, most powerful way is what you focus on. If you focus on it, it's an opportunity to break through, then you will break through, right?
Yeah.
If you focus on this is how poor, poor, pitiful me, like a lot of people do, like what happened in COVID, a lot of people said, poor, poor, pitiful me. Well, you know, a lot of people grew out of COVID.
Right.
Right. So, all right. So it's all the first thing is what you focus on. So yes, I agree with that statement.
Very powerful. I want to talk about this. The Red Cross was there by your bedside. You know, after you dove into the river, I'm going to paint the picture for everybody. Dave was the last person off the plane, dove into the river when he helped so many other people. And the ships showed up right away. And Dave dove into the water and swam. And if you've ever met Dave in person, he's very tall. How tall are you, Dave?
Oh, I'm only 6'1", but I'm getting shorter every day, I think.
Well, yeah. I think you were 6'2" when we met.
Yeah, and, yep.
And he's built like a football player, so you're thinking, yep, this is going to be an easy swim. But in the ice-cold waters of the Hudson River, he almost didn't make it. And I believe it was two firefighters grabbed you and pulled you out of the water, pulled you up on deck.
And sure, yep.
Yeah, and this is a very powerful thing, Dave, because there are moments in life where you just cannot help yourself. And here you had somebody reach out. But anyways, Dave wound up in a hospital bed in New York City, and the mayor came to see him, press was there, and the Red Cross was by your side. And because of that, I believe you talked about this, you dedicated a lot of your work to help raising money for the Red Cross. And I think you've raised about $14.8 million for them. Let's talk about that because, yeah, you know, that's a huge organization to help out.
Well, you know, I appreciate you bringing that up because they were there three times for me that day at the dock right there to help me get to the triage center, got me clothes when I didn't have any clothes. And then back home, they were the lady here in Charlotte, the CEO, Pam, was taking care of my family. So I have a very close connection and very big passion for what they do during a traumatic experience. And I mean, they do it all the time, right? Floods, like right now, right. Floods out in the West Coast, right? So they're doing it all the time. So I told myself, and I said, you know what? Yeah, if I'm going to give to somebody, I'm going to give to somebody who does something for somebody else and help change the direction of somebody else's life. And they changed my life. So yeah, I got help raise a lot of money. My first book, we donated a portion of that book to the Red Cross. But no, I think it's one thing I've learned. It's all, yeah, one of the biggest things out of this, and this, yeah, one of the fastest ways out of a traumatic or depressed state is show gratitude. And if you show gratitude every day, you can't be in a fearful state. I don't care what you say. So give thanks to whatever you want to give thanks to, whatever you call your greater being, whatever it is. But give thanks every day. And so that gave me the fortitude and the opportunity and the energy to be able to do this. And then we're doing another one actually coming up here in Washington, D.C. in 2 weeks. I'm really excited to be back in with the Red Cross.
That's fantastic. How do we get a hold of you? We go to DaveSandersonSpeaks.com. Is that correct? .com.
Yep. That's the best way. Yeah. Correct. Yep.
Yeah. Reach out to Dave. He's doing leadership trainings, keynote speeches, the whole nine yards. I want to ask you, you are working with corporations, you're working with young leaders. And I feel that in this day and age, a lot of these organizations, especially the Fortune 500s and the Fortune 100s, they're having trouble finding that next generation of leader, that young, you know, who is that young go-getter? You know, they're having trouble finding them. What do you tell these organizations when you train, when you talk, and when you go into these places and you just kind of go, how do you pick the winners? You know what I mean?
Yep. Yeah, that's I will answer this in two levels. First thing, when I have this opportunity to have this conversation is, and I don't know if you believe in this. I mean, you taught me a lot about millennials. And one of the things I believe about millennials, I think I heard from you, was a millennials, I believe, is the problem, and Gen Zs, so I'm taking this as a bigger group, right, are some of the smartest people ever to come out. They've got intelligence. What they don't have is wisdom.
Yeah.
And that's the challenge. Wisdom is basically taking the intelligence, and what do you do with the intelligence? But what I find when I'm talking to these young leaders, and when I consult with companies, and they say, well, what's your perspective? I said, well, one of the things I realized when I talk to these younger people is their lack of focus of purpose. They don't know what they're here for. They're out there. They want to make a difference, and they have a whole different perspective.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've learned from a book that I read is called The Fourth Turning.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've never read the book, it's really about understanding the patterns of the seasons of life. And how, you know, if you look at where, when you grew up, go back four generations or three generations, which would be four, pretty much what was going on in the United States then was going on when you're doing this, right? When you were growing up. So if you understand that pattern, you understand, you know, so you look back at this generation, right? It's what? It's the early or late 1940s, early 1950s.
Yeah.
A lot of, just got out of a war, ta-da. Right.
Yeah.
We just have a new president, older president, you know, economy was pretty good. And all of a sudden, you know, we have a it was back then it was communism. Right.
Right.
So
right.
Now it may be communism and terrorism. So
right.
It just repeats itself. Number one, understand history. Number one. But number two, I said, what I find with what I said, I tell what organizations are looking for. And I tell these, this is to young people. They're looking for three things. First, they're looking for somebody who has confidence, who can step up and have confidence to be able to handle something. Second, they have to have competence. They got to be able to do it. But third is where I think makes the difference. And what helped me as I started transitioning in my sales career, they're looking for somebody who's bringing some creativity to the position.
Yeah.
And if you can bring those three things, you all of a sudden are adding significant value to somebody, and that's where the leaders are going to start stepping out. Confidence, competence, and creativity.
It's amazing you said that, because when I walk into an organization, you can spot the people who have that energy, that light. You automatically want to follow them. They have a leadership quality about them, and it's not arrogance. It's not I'm better. It's more they have this inspiration when you're around them, and they have clarity. We are in a day and age where there's no one way of doing things. You and I are baby boomers, Dave.
Yep.
And there was only one way to do a task, you remember?
That's right.
And if you did it any other way, your bosses not only yelled at you, they fired you. There was no patience there. And now we have a generation that if you say, let's do this, they will find 3 to 5 different ways to do it more efficiently. They're all about efficiency, this next generation.
Right.
They hate wasted time. They hate wasted energy. They want to work fast and then get to a little leisure time. And so when you talk about creativity to get to that mountaintop, that to me is that icing on the cake, that je ne sais quoi, that thing that I think millennials have in spades. But you're right. They lack the wisdom. And there's something else I think that boomer parents have failed to do this with the next generation, because we raised them. We yep. listened to the experts, you know, like Dr. Spock, and we removed understanding the bigger picture, seeing the bigger picture, and knowing their place in an organization. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, I would reference my eldest daughter. That's a perfect example of what you just said of my eldest daughter. She's a millennial, right? Very intelligent. Got a college degree, gets a job, thinks she can walk into the CEO's office anytime and just sort of sit down and have a conversation, tell him what she wants.
Right.
And she learned very quickly that there's still protocol. There is some protocol still left. And though, once you started bringing some creative solutions, right? Well, I think we can do this better. Then she got people's attention. She employed the creativity side. So I totally agree with that. And I think that, this younger generation, man, I was just reading a story about Steve Jobs the other day, but why the iPhone looks like the iPhone. It hasn't changed. And you probably know this story. And I heard, I'm like, that's brilliant. All right.
Tell it. I don't want to hear this.
And one of the reasons he obviously noticed, he always wore a black turtleneck.
Right.
Right? There's a reason behind it. He hated buttons. So he never wore a shirt with buttons. And if you do it, the iPhones, very few buttons. Because what did the iPhone, come after? The BlackBerry.
Yes.
With buttons.
Oh, my Lord. Yes, you're right.
I read this and I'm like, this is brilliant. So this generation and the people who work there are always thinking outside the box about, efficiency, right? Efficiency. Yeah. Yep.
Now that I'm a Mac Apple nerd. My girlfriend always makes fun of me because she's Android. But this makes total sense. It's the simplicity of design that really makes it what it is. I'm blown away by this. But very true. And it also breaks it down into something else, and that's KISS. Keep it simple. Almost stupid. Yeah. I don't want to say stupid, but so simple a six-year-old could figure it out. Do you see too many organizations getting too complex? They have an employee handbook that is like 120 to 300 pages long of what you can and cannot do. Let's talk about that a little bit, because that's the number one thing that creates bottlenecks, cogs in the wheel. And this generation, getting back to this generation, if they can't see a career path in front of them, they will quit.
They'll walk. They walk immediately. That's what my daughter did. Exactly. She walked a couple of times. So, I totally agree with this. I mean, it's, I look back at my time when I was at Oracle in the corporate world, right?
Yeah.
And I had a taste of entrepreneurism, right? I had a taste of it. And I'm working with Oracle and I'm thinking, why do they do this way? Right. I mean, there's a clear pathway, right? There's a clear pathway. And we're making so many hurdles, right, for the client to buy. Why do we do this? And so I think it's one of the great things about like what you do and I do, being an entrepreneur or solopreneur, or whatever you want to call it, is we can sort of, look at the bigger picture and go, I got to keep this simple. And I got to keep my message simple. I mean, one of the things I was very flawed at, Brad, when I started all this, I was in the corporate mindset. I worked for Oracle in a corporate mindset. So I was thinking, all right, big mission statement, all this and that. And all of a sudden I realized over the last few years, and it's accelerated my growth, is, what do I do? I help people create opportunity out of uncertainty. Simple, right? And people get it. People get it.
Wait a minute. It's that simple?
Duh. Right. It's like, Dave, it only took you 12 years, right, to figure that one out. But I was in a corporate world. So I was thinking corporately, right?
Well, you're thinking acronyms and, I have to impress this corporation. And, the hardest thing for any speaker or anybody who's an author or who's running around doing keynotes is figuring out your own marketing. And if you don't do that, I look at it this way. Every single person on earth should write down a mission statement. What is your purpose here? What is it? My mission statement is basically to ignite game-changing conversations. That's what it is. Am I correct on that? Do you have a mission statement?
Yes, I do. And I wrote it October 24th, 1994. And it was a game changer for me when I wrote it down that day. And I remember it was like yesterday, Brad, because I was confused. I'm like, okay, what is my mission, right? And then I was listening. There was a song U2 came out, and I heard it. The U2 song was playing in the background, and I heard it, and all of a sudden I was like, I got it. And it wasn't from that song. It was basically from the rhythm of the song,
right?
Right. And I was listening to this, and so, yeah, I mean, if you look at my missions, I, Dave Sanderson, see, hear, feel, and know the purpose of my life is to be happy, realizing I accomplish anything I desire and have faith in my Creator, inspiring others to be the same. That's what I wrote down in October 24th, 1994. And that's what I've been striving to do.
I love that you have the Creator in there, because I think that's important. And for those of you who are listening, two things. I want the generations to know we admire you. We look at you and we go, wow, you are incredibly intelligent. We're just trying to show you the pathway that we made the mistakes on, and you are making the same mistakes. We're just trying to help. And then the other side of this is, you know, I think everybody should craft their mission statement, define it, really break down, take the most positive words and phrases that you use every day. And it's really not that hard. You're actually probably doing your mission statement right now, and you don't even realize it. You know, look at Dave. He is the embodiment of his mission statement, probably before he even wrote it down. He just, you figure it out, and you narrow that lane, and you go for it. So
that's, and you got to immerse yourself in it. You got to put it in your heart. You got to ingrain in yourself, right? That's, I mean, like I said, this is almost 30 years, it's over 30 years old now. Right.
Yeah.
But it, I got it in my heart so deep that I can just say it. Right. It's because it's in there so deep. Yeah. You know?
That's phenomenal. I want to talk about this, and you know, it's up to you, but you worked with Tony Robbins for a little while. Did that have an impact on you? Because I know you and I have broken bread and sat down and talked. Yeah. And I was very impressed, and I've always been impressed by his work. Let's talk about that experience. I'm sure a lot of his work rubbed off on you, and helped you when the plane went down in the Hudson.
Oh yeah. Thank you. I mean, it's, I'm very honored that Tony invited me to be on his team and then head of security for him. I mean, it was a huge honor. And it was a timely part in my life, because here's the backstory to the backstory really quickly. Yeah. 1984, my first mentor came into my life. And he had significant impact. That's what my second book's about, From Turmoil to Triumph. I talk about that experience of having a first mentor who was 77 back in 1984, right? And took a young buck of 24, 25 on, right, for 13 years.
Yeah.
Bill passed away in September of 1997. It was December of 1997 when Tony asked me to be his first assistant head of security and then head of security. So I believe, one thing that I believe, and you can believe it or not, you know, mentors come into your life at the right time. You just got to recognize it. So when he invited me to do that, I was overwhelmed, and it was going to take quite a commitment of time. But when that next master comes in, right, and what the opportunity to be around, just the energy and see how he acted and see the, and how he impressed on people, how they could change their lives. And I did this for over 10 years, as you know, being around him. So, I mean, one of the things he did for me is take what I learned and basically gave me distinctions around it. I mean, right. I've learned many things from him, but there were the distinctions, little things, and how to use it. And then, of course, you know, he was the only one that called me in the hospital the evening of January 15th. Why my company didn't call me, he did. And then one of the things he did for me, which was, I thank him. I'll thank him every day of the rest of my life, is he said, when you get to LA, call me, because he lived in Palm Springs at that point.
Yeah.
And I was going to LA to do all these TV shows, and I called him, and he spent 3 hours basically coaching me on what to expect, the mindset, what things are probably going to come at me that I wasn't expecting. And he gave me basically that, I call it doctorial, on how to really manage yourself in a situation that you're going to be going in that you have no clue that you're going to be involved with. And to this day, I mean, he was very kind to write a piece for my book, From Turmoil to Triumph. So I'm very, I think anytime you have an opportunity to be around a master, you do it.
I agree.
I spend over five figures right now every year on just putting myself in proximity of these people. You know?
Smart.
Yep.
I think that's the one thing that's missing. We're in a day and age where you can go and look up a YouTube video and people think they're a master of the craft because they watched a YouTube video. And it's not like that. It's like the martial arts. If you're arrogant enough to walk into a dojo as a white belt and you think you can beat up the sensei, good luck with that. It's about patience. It's about dropping the ego. It's about listening and realizing this person with all this experience I need that because I think the best way to live life, and I didn't learn this till I was in my late 40s, is watch other people who've gone through what you either are about to go through, going through, or would like to do, and listen to them. And that's everything from divorce on up to being a multimillionaire. Listen, 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 and follow the people who are going through it. Do not listen to the people who've never gone through it. 95% of the business gurus out there, the people who are writing business books and teaching at our universities in the business and entrepreneurial space have never owned a business. So where are you going to turn for information? You know, you go through trauma, you talk to someone like Dave. What is one of your favorite people you've coached? And if you can't leave details, that's fine. But either an organization or an individual, you watch them transform.
Yeah, thank you. There's been a couple, and I won't name their names because of confidentiality. But when I started with one of them, he was a successful salesperson transitioning out, but he lacked a lot of self-confidence. And what I realized is after our talks and sort of getting in his head, one of the things I do every time, I give everybody I speak with a Colby Index, which helps me understand how they think, how they process. So if I understand that, then I can sort of structure the way I'm going to ask questions. And what we really came down to is this, Brad, is after asking the questions, I did a Colby. He basically had his biggest challenge wasn't in business. The reason he had self-confidence is because his dad always demeaned him. He was never good enough to his dad. Yeah. And so once we got over that, now he's thriving. His business is thriving right now. And he's got a very niche market, and he's basically owning that market. So, you know, I think you got to understand what that deep – it may not be a business issue. Probably not a business issue.
Yeah,
it's probably something deeper down that you've experienced in the past. And what you just said is one thing I preach, is model to somebody who's done walk their talk. Don't ever model somebody who hasn't walked their talk, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, Tony told me that. Bill told me that. Don, my current mentor, told me that. Everybody, if they haven't walked the walk, run. Get away from them.
And we're in a day and age where everybody has
You go on TikTok, you're an authority, right? You go on TikTok, you're an authority.
When I hear people who say they have imposter syndrome, I kind of chuckle a little bit, because the only reason you would have imposter syndrome is if you're entering into a world that is kind of new to what you're trying to teach. And that doesn't mean you don't expand or try to push yourself into a new area, but we are living in the day and age of people being an instant guru. You know, I've seen these people film their apartment, and I know it's their apartment complex's, you know, common area. I've seen them rent a McLaren for the day so they can look whatever. We are in a day and age of fakery, and it's easy to fake. And I love the fact that you are incredibly authentic, and you point them in the right direction, and you help so, so many people. I guess my next question is, how do you balance your life? Because I see you flying a lot. I see you speaking a lot. I see you swimming in the Hudson. Yeah. Thank God you didn't swim in the East River in New York. It would have been a much more traumatic experience.
After Seinfeld, watching Kramer do that in Seinfeld, yeah, you're right. I want no part of the East River. No part.
I lived in New York City for 35 years, and I can tell you the place is not to go. Okay.
No.
Go ahead. I want to know a little bit about your story when it comes to balance, because there are some people talk about getting up in the morning and meditating and, you know, doing calisthenics, and then others are saying whatever. What is your secret to the work-life balance?
Well, thanks. I will lead off with a quick story, then I'll tell you how I do it. So here's the backstory again. So after the Miracle on the Hudson, Tony Robbins' first event after that was in Secaucus, New Jersey. All right. His assistant called me and asked me if I was going to be there, because it was like 4 or 5 weeks after the plane crash, right? And I didn't know, right? So I said, I'll be there. And one of the things that Tony does before Tony goes on stage, I'm sure he still does it. I haven't been with him for a few years. He does a power walk. Right. He gets himself going, right? Gets himself in state. And the head of security does that power walk with him.
Right.
So here I am, I'm walking with Tony. And Tony asked me, he said, are you doing all right? And I'm like, sure I am. You know, one thing is, you know, if you've been around Tony, and I've been around Tony, he can read people just like that.
Yeah.
He can read people. And he said, are you really all right? And I know. I said, I'm a mess. I mean, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm all over the place. And he said, remember that time we were in Fiji? You were out of balance. He said, when you go home, you've got to get yourself back in balance. He said, remember how you did that in Fiji. And so he did a neuro association with me, right? Went back to Fiji. What I did, Brad, in fact, is sitting right over here. I bought a big Swiss ball. Wow. And if I could sit on the Swiss ball, I'm in balance. Yeah. So when I'm out of balance, I sit on my Swiss ball, and that gives me balance. And then I go second part. How do I do it? I structure my week in three different modes. First mode is I have what's called buffer days. Monday and Friday are usually buffer days, which means that's this Dave creativity day. That's all Dave does is creativity, right? Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday are focus days. Those are revenue producing days. And Saturday and Sunday are shutdown free days. And that, and usually it's a half of a free day on Saturday, but the full day Sunday. So it gives me the time to reprogram my mind and say, okay. And one of the things, I wrote an article about this. I don't know if you ever watched this TV show, Yellowstone.
Yes.
One of the things that I wrote about, and at first I thought I would get a lot of backlash, but I said, the article was called, the blog was called, Every Day You Got to Go to the Train Station. And if you didn't, I had to explain it for some people. I said, it's not the train station you see in Yellowstone. It's the train station of the crap in your mind. Every day you got to go to the train station, dump it where so no one ever finds it. And no one ever, you know about it. And that's what I do every morning. You know, when I get up at 4:50 before I go swim, I dump the crap the previous day because we all got crap. This would be very candid. We all got stuff. I dump it at the train station, Brad. That's what I do every morning. That's how I do it.
That is worth its weight in gold right there. That is a wisdom note that everybody should be writing down. Get up and dump your crap because you can wake up, you know, being tense and not realizing why.
Yeah. And how you, why you start your day, and more importantly, why would you put that on anybody else during that day? Right.
Right.
And people are going to read that stuff. So that lesson from Tony, go back to where you found balance was the first step, sitting on a Swiss ball.
Yeah. Dave Sanderson, thank you so much for being on Awakened Nation, my friend. Please, everybody reach out, watch Dave's videos, pick up his books, and he has a magazine out, Moments Matter. It's a phenomenal read. He's had some amazing cover articles on there. And go to www.davesandersonspeaks.com. If you're a corporation, I suggest you hire Dave because he will transform your young leaders and make them think a little bit differently. But I'm not going to let you go yet, Dave. I have my lightning round. I always do.
Okay. Move rock.
You got it.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
You're welcome. I want to ask you, out of everything you've been through, and this is my favorite question, but what is your favorite memory?
You know, I tell you my favorite memory. We're going to go back. I was at a President's Club trip for a company named ADP. It's the first President's Club I went to, and it was in Hawaii, but Hawaii wasn't that. It was 2 days later when my wife and I flew to Carmel, and I was standing on the first tee at Pebble Beach, and I'm like, wow, right? I gave my wife, back then it cost $300 to play Pebble Beach. I gave my wife $300 to go shopping. I said, here, you go shopping, right? But I have to say that was, and there's a lot of moments, but that moment is standing on the tee. I mean, here I'm at Pebble Beach playing golf. You know, at 7 o'clock in the morning, and I'm like, you know, how many people would die to have this opportunity?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So yeah.
And just to add to this, do you find yourself sometimes you come up with an idea, a place you want to go to, something you want to manifest, and then after it happens, there's this other level of things that come into your life, and you almost have to pinch yourself because you didn't wish for this; it just came almost as a package. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, I think the more you give out, all this stuff comes back to you tenfold. So if you give out gratitude, give out this, and you have this experience, and all of a sudden you're like, someone may open up a whole unique experience that you would never had the opportunity to experience, right? And I think I've been blessed, and I think it's because I've been really focused on giving first. Like, I mean, it's not new. Zig Ziglar said it, right? I mean, this goes back generations. So I'm not saying, but the younger people don't know who Zig Ziglar is. They don't understand that he was the man, right? He was the man.
Yeah.
And his give first, right? Give first, and it'll come back. So, yeah, I agree.
My second question is, what is your greatest hope over the next 20 years?
Well, my goal is to live to 139 years old. That's my goal. And people say, why? No one's ever done it. How are you going to do it? Well, number one, there's a couple of things behind. Number one, yes, there have been people living that long, right? And the way aging is going right now, if you take care of yourself. But here's the reason. It came to me about a year ago, Brad. I was sitting in a meeting, and the light bulb went off. Because if I I want to live to 85. Then I'm three quarters of the way through my life.
Right.
And I'm going to start acting that way. If I say I'm going to live to 139, I'm not even halfway through my life yet. And I could act like I'm 20, 30 years old and go back and swim with all these people and do all these crazy things with these younger people. And I could show people how to do it. So, and people say, well, why 139? Because I want to be around for the year, you know, when it gets that the next millennial, right? I want to see them. I want to see two millennials. That's my goal.
Yep. You know, I'm going to up mine. I always wanted to live to be 120. I'm going to up mine to 140. How's that?
Yep.
Well, we'll be there together. It's like, hey.
We'll see the next millennial, and we'll say, you know what? I was there the last one, man.
Yeah.
And it did not melt down like everybody said it was going to melt down. Right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yep. My final question is, when you meet your maker, God, can you honestly say you've lived your purpose and your mission?
That is my ultimate goal. My ultimate goal every day is what I do today. How does that glorify God? If I can glorify God every day, then I've lived. Even if I might maybe not made the money I want, at least I've done that. So when I, my goal is when I get to that time, it's like you say, all right, you've done a good job. No one's perfect, right? We're all failed. But I think when you get to that point, if I keep focused on that every day, if I can glorify God in some way, then I'll be received well, and I'll hopefully get to that next step.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dave Sanderson. Thank you, Dave, for being on Awakened Nation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Brad, for having me. God bless.
Hey, everybody. Tune in next week for another extraordinary guest here on Awakened Nation. Until then, have a great week. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for being a big part of the Awakened Nation movement. This is how you can help me and our extraordinary guests. If you guys enjoyed this episode, please share it out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And let's grow this movement by word of mouth. Our success will be because of you. Thank you, and see you next week.